I went through a spiritual crisis. How could I live in this body that had been mutilated? When you strip away all the rhetoric, infant circumcision is essentially a spiritual wound.
You're listening to the Brendan Morata Show.
In this episode, I talked to Brother K, founder of the Intactivist protest organization Bloodstained Men and Their Friends. Bloodstained Men are known for their iconic style of protest, in which they wear all white with a bloodstain over the genitals to symbolize the harm of circumcision. When many people think of what an Intactivist is, the Bloodstained Men are one of the first images that come to mind. During this episode, we talk about the spiritual wound of circumcision, how to stage an effective protest, and how Brother K is using shock and symbols to awaken the public on this issue. Now, here is Brother K. So, when you meet someone and they're exposed to the Bloodstained Men for the first time, or they're meeting you for the first time, or they're seeing a protest for the first time, and they ask, like, what's this all about? Like, what are you guys doing? How is it you usually introduce yourself or the group to them?
I tell them that we're a group of concerned Americans who are trying to shock the public into awareness on this issue that so many people are apathetic or indifferent about because they've never thought about it. They've never read about it. Circumcision is one of those background cultural phenomena. It's unique. Actually, it's unique. I shouldn't say one of those. It's as you know, and I'm sure you have your own war stories, with all the things you went through, you know, doing your movie and getting it broadcast, published. I tell them that, yeah, we are here to shock the public. We're not timid about it. We intend to shock the public into an awareness that this issue matters, that human rights matters, that the genitals of a person, of a human being, matter. And it's insane the length that some people will go to not to talk about the penis when they're more than happy to talk about women, female circumcision, women's genitals. And usually the more eager they are to talk about female circumcision, the more remote they are from it. So you'll find a lot of American women, well, why don't you talk about female circumcision? We all know, everyone in this movement knows that the problem in the United States is not female circumcision. We know it's going on among some ethnic communities underground or, you know, illegally. But that's a different issue than something like infant male circumcision that's going on openly, above board, in hospitals, in medical clinics. It's absolutely insane that the American medical community has normalized the genital mutilation of boys. I think it's clinically insane, seriously. And I do know that there are European psychiatrists and psychologists who agree with that concept, that it's clinically insane to cut the genitals of any child. But in the United States, the problem is we're cutting the genitals of newborn boys. And so that's what I tell people. Yeah, we're here to shock you. We want you to go to our website. We want you to look at Doctors Opposing Circumcision. We want you to see the movie put out called American Circumcision, The Elephant in the Hospital on YouTube. We throw in the whole everything, including the kitchen sink, at the American people. It's a crisis, as I've said so many times, and it remains a crisis. It's a daily crisis in America, in the United States. It is a daily crisis. When you strap down a human being and you cut off part of their sex organ, there is no more profound crisis in the life of an individual than that. And multiply that by 3,000 a day, which is roughly the number of boys, newborn boys, American citizens who are going through that ordeal, that trauma. It breaks my heart. And I know that people burn out on this issue and wonder why I haven't burned out. It's just not in my nature to burn out on this issue. I take breaks. I had a lot of time off when I was raising my family. Now with the Bloodstain, having discovered the Bloodstain suit, I mean, I don't know what my Intactivism would be like without the Bloodstain suit, but when I saw that symbol, when Jonathan Conte brought those seven Bloodstain suits to New Orleans and we put them on, I felt it. I knew it. It was a a primordial truth that we were wearing on our bodies in a socially acceptable way in public, that you could show bleeding genitals and still be legal. The bloodstained suit, in the most profound symbolic way, shows the injured penises and injured penis of a man and the injured penises of a whole nation of men. So that's somewhat how I start out.
I think there's a lot of really interesting things you said there. And one of the ones that stands out to me is the idea of shocking the public or revealing to them how shocking this issue actually is. Because that is an aspect of the bloodstained men that both draws people to them and makes them really curious and wonder what's this about, and has generated a lot of interest in your group, a lot of media attention, a lot of people who want to join the protests. And it's also the thing that draws the most criticism, is the fact that it's shocking and some people are drawn to that and curious about it, and some are pushed away by it or not sure how to respond to it. But it sounds like for you, the reason that you've chosen a symbol that's very shocking or a style of protest that's very attention-getting is because the act of circumcision itself is very shocking. And you're trying to highlight the actual shock through a symbol that represents that shock.
Well said. Yes. Because it's so common, and because doctors and nurses, American hospitals have normalized it with this, it's almost like, I hate to use the word almost, but they have made it a religion, a medical religion. And they've wrapped it in all kinds of serious and pompous sounding words. And they intonate all these things about, yes, it will. If you watch a circumcision video with some of these doctors, they love narrating a circumcision. You get that they feel like God when they're doing this to a child. And with circumcision, yes, it's more than shocking. It's devastating. It's excruciating. It's excruciating to realize what has been done to you or your father or your brother or all your friends. It is shocking. It's devastating. And that brings me to an idea that I want to talk to you about, which is that circumcision, when you strip away all the rhetoric, which is what I'm indicating that the hospitals and the medical community has wrapped it in. They've wrapped it in a whole facade of rhetoric. There is an elemental existential reality or entity involved in the experience for the child and for the operator or the person doing it. And it reaches some kind of mystical, or it is for all of them, it is some kind of mystical, dreadful experience of all the supernatural and ineffable aspects of life that we all feel. And at the height of sexual ecstasy, everyone knows what that feels like. It's the closest we come to feelings of creation. When you operate on the sex organ of a human being, you are bringing all of that into that experience, all of those feelings into that experience. And even the child feels it. Even these babies, they know at some deep inner level of their being that their sexual life is being tampered with, is being injured, is being destroyed. So infant circumcision is essentially a spiritual mutilation, a lessening, a spiritual lessening, a breaking of some essential aspect of your human identity. It's a breaking of it. It's a cutting away of it. And you leave a lesser, a diminished, broken human being behind. Now, we all heal. I mean, we heal in our own ways, but you have broken an essential part of that human being.
So one of the things that's really interesting to me about what you're saying, a lot of the ideas you're articulating, I've read in academic literature and in texts on spirituality or intellectual thought. So right now I'm reading a book called Medical Nemesis by Ivan Illich. And in it, he talks about this idea of doctors as priests. And I'm also reading The Birth of the Clinic by Michel Foucault, who he uses instead of the word rhetoric, he uses discourse to describe the language by which people talk about things and how discourse can obscure or create forms of power. And it sounds like what you're articulating is that on a primal level, we all have a natural response to seeing a child in danger or seeing a child harmed. We also have a primal response, or maybe even a spiritual response, to sexuality. And so when harm is done there, there's a level of rhetoric and language required to obscure that harm, and that you are attempting to reveal that harm by going beyond language into a sort of symbol or performance art. And that's actually one of the things I wanted to ask you about, is how you adopted the name Brother K and what drew you to the bloodstained symbol and those sort of things, because that strikes me as a very visual representation of something that is obscured through language. And I think the language that you talk about this issue with is very interesting and different than some of the more academic speaking people who talk on this issue. So how is it that you came to the name Brother K and this particular symbol, and got involved on this issue in general?
Okay, you had a number of questions there in there. So I don't think I can balance them all in my mind. So I'll start with my name.
Sure.
And then I'll rely on your memory to
I'll come back to them.
To bring it back in. When I say that circumcision is essentially a spiritual wound to a human being, that's the reality of it. That is just the deepest reality of what it means to be thrown down and have part of your organ of life generation hacked at. What is done to a newborn baby's penis could easily be done by a pack of hyenas who selectively only went after the penis. That's the spiritual experience for the baby, that his penis is being attacked by a pack of wild hyenas. That's the reality of it. The baby has no concept that, oh, well, this is a doctor who's wrapped himself in all this baloney in order to stand above him and chop off part of his organ of generation. So there's so much going on when a baby experiences that injury, that wound, and then the subsequent suffering that he endures and the identity that he then builds up, largely based around healing from that wound. There are people who say, well, you're trying to blame all the problems of the world on having part of your penis cut off. No. We know that cruelty and barbarism has existed in most cultures and countries throughout history. But that's not our problem in dealing with the psychological injury of what American doctors are doing to our babies. We have an actual problem that we can solve. And we believe that when we solve problems like that, we make a better society. So when I was just born on October 22nd, 1947, I've pieced this together as best as I can. I was taken away from my mother. My mother was sent to another room, a maternity ward. I don't know if they still do it like that, but they had, from the way she described it, there was anywhere from 8 to 12 to 15 women in that maternity ward at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. And I was taken, and as near as I could determine, circumcised within the first hours of my life. The circumstraint board had not yet been invented. I was born in 47. It was invented in 55. So most likely the way that I was circumcised was the doctor stood at my feet and went at my penis, from there, and a nurse stood over me and at my head and leaned over me, held down my legs with her hands, and simultaneously used her elbows to hold down my arms. Now, I was fully conscious, so I'm looking up at this body of this, I want to say hyena. because to the baby, what is being done is essentially the attack of wild animals. It's alien to the mammalian culture for a child to perceive the attack on himself as from his mother. And that brings up a whole nother thing that we can talk about if we have time today.
Sure.
Think Miriam Pollack, which I'm sure you've read her article. So after that experience, I don't know if I passed. I don't think I did pass out. But when they, several hours later, when they brought me into the maternity ward, my mother was, I guess all the women were staring at the door to see who was going to be brought in next. I mean, it sounds like a really strange way of giving birth, but that's what they did to all these women in this room, and they're all waiting for their own baby to be brought in. And when they brought me in to the room, apparently I was quite a sight. I had just been circumcised, and my mother loved telling this story later on, and she would always conclude it with, "And look how fine you turned out." But her first thought upon seeing me is, apparently I was a frightful sight. She said, "Oh my God," "Oh my God, I hope that's not mine." And that was like one of those family stories she would tell, you know, at almost every, you know, Thanksgiving dinner. We heard that story several times growing up.
Wow.
Yeah. That's, oh my God, I hope that's not mine.
It strikes me that the telling of that story must have had an impact on you as much as, or in relationship to the original wounding of circumcision. In other words, I'm certain that the original wounding of circumcision was intense, but then hearing that story over and over again, did you feel like that had any impact on you?
At the time, not consciously, but clearly I remembered it. But boom, maternal bond broken.
Yeah.
Period. Maternal bond broken. And you've done enough work yourself to understand the significance of that statement. That is what circumcision does. It breaks the maternal bond, period. You cannot do that to a child and expect it. And in fact, I would not feed for 3 days after that. They became very, very concerned.
Wow.
About my life. I would not feed, period, nothing. And finally, after 3 days, they tried goat's milk, and I took that. At some point in my early adulthood, when I became aware of how devastating it was to lose part of my penis, it infuriated me. It enraged me. And that's not an uncommon feeling for men to have. I mean, it's a normal feeling. It's a normal feeling for a man who is aware of what's been done to him. And this is one of the feelings that men are expressing in bringing intactivism to the forefront in the United States. But How do you heal from that rage? How do you heal from that anger? How do you heal from it? I think that's a concern among a lot of the conservative forces. And by conservative, I don't mean political, but the conservative forces of society or of the social order, who just, they are terrified of any kind of change. It doesn't matter what it is, but the conservative forces of the social order are to maintain the status quo, because it's what got us here, and it's dangerous to veer away from it. By my late 30s, as circumcision continued to enrage me and disturb me, and I had already protested against it at that point, which we can talk about that also, but I went through a spiritual crisis of epic proportions. Like, how could I live in this body that had been mutilated at the core of my sexual identity? When I realized the fullness of the spiritual connection between the genital wounding and my existence as a person, my identity as a person, which is your name, they give you a name. The naming, circumcision in many cultures, is when you are given your name or a name. And in fact, that's right there in Genesis 17, when Abram was circumcised and became Abraham. It occurred to me that I could change my name as a way of rejecting the name, the naming, the circumcision naming that I had suffered. Because I don't see them as separate. I see them as conjoined. I liked the spiritual connotations of brother K. It just felt right. So I went to the courthouse and inquired about it, got the papers, published a notice in the local newspaper, you know, that makes it clear you're not trying to avoid debts and whatnot, and appeared before a judge, and he granted my name change. And it represented and was a tremendous spiritual healing for me. And I can't imagine that I would be able to do this work without it. For me,
it sounds like for you, the feelings that circumcision created were there from the beginning, and that your awareness of it, I mean, was there a moment in which you first became aware of it, or was it something that, since there was this family story, you were always aware of?
I wouldn't say I was always aware of it. No. It was a gradual awareness. I can't say it was any one dramatic moment. No, it was gradual.
One of the things I find interesting about your story is that it sounds like you're almost using shamanic work to try to heal and integrate this wound. So when in traditional shamanic work, people use story and symbols and things like that in order to change their psyche and the psyche of others. And a name change is something that in traditional cultures will happen in shamanic ceremonies to symbolize that you've gone from one identity to another.
Interesting.
And so a lot of this stuff that it sounds like you're doing is an unconscious reaching for things that traditional cultures have done for thousands of years, which is that they'll, you know, wear certain symbols, or they'll have certain names and things like that in order to shift the psyche of themselves and those around them. And it sounds like for you, there's also, because this is activism, there's an element of using those to shift the psyche of others. So I'm curious at what point you began not just wanting to work through or transform your own feelings around the issue, but transform the larger society.
That brings in my experiences as a young man growing up during the civil rights era, the Vietnam War era, the draft resistance era, which happened at the same time as the Vietnam War. And so this was the early 70s. As my awareness grew about the human rights, the blatant human rights violation of cutting off part of a person's penis, as my awareness of that grew, at the same time, I was seeing the end of the Vietnam War. I went to college in the late 60s. I had been part of the anti-war movement, protesting. And I actually thought and talked to people about why was no one protesting circumcision. I didn't understand it. I really, because I saw so many protests on so many issues, everything except circumcision. And I couldn't figure it out. Why was no one protesting circumcision? At some point, I did realize that I couldn't expect anyone to protest it if I wasn't willing to do it or if I couldn't do it. That does bring in the difficulty of protesting it. And, you know, stop me if I bounce around. But the inherent in circumcising a man is creating a sexual shame and guilt in him. One of the things that a spiritual wound does to an individual is it makes you feel guilty. Dostoevsky called it guilty without guilt, but it makes you feel guilty. Circumcision is perceived as a punishment. And in fact, it is a punishment. So it's the worst punishment possible, other than just slamming the baby down to the floor and stomping on his head.
Yeah, there's an unconscious belief in the child that whatever happens to him, he must have caused in some way. So if there's someone harming a child, the child on some level assumes, like, did I do this? Did something I do this?
Guilt.
So,
and to further complicate the psychodynamics of what's going on inside a man's head on this issue, and why men are reluctant to speak out, is the complicating factor of our own sexual desires or sexual aspirations. We don't get here just by accident. We are the result of sex. We are born out of the bodies of women who had sex with a man. Sex is the foundational aspect of existence for all creatures, certainly all mammals. And I don't want to get into, you know, but you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
When you put this genital wound in there with all the other aspects of a man's sexuality, which normally he's not going to want to talk about, you know, unless it's, you know, bragging in the locker room. But men don't like bad news about sex. And to hear that you're living your life with an injured sex organ, with an impartial sex organ, and all the other, well, aspects of the foreskin itself being a sensory organ that actually allows you a deeper, more. I saw something on horse's whiskers the other night. Some people trim them off apparently for appearance or something, but the horse's whiskers are actually sense organs. And I started thinking about that, and I started posting more about that, that the foreskin is actually the sense organ of the penis. The rest of the penis is there to do the job and, you know, to facilitate what's going on. But the foreskin itself, and that's why it's a sacrifice. That's why it's a sacrifice to cut it off. It's clearly it's a sacrifice to take away the sensory organ of the penis. So men are devastated by that awareness, by that loss. The loss is, the awareness only makes the loss even worse. And the fact that you were lied to, no one likes to be a sucker. And every circumcised man has been treated like a sucker. I mean, that's just a fact.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like that part of the challenge of talking about this issue is that it goes against one of the central needs that men have, which is to feel like they're sexually virile or masculine. And that it does a blow to that part of the ego to admit that there might have been some way in which that was harmed. And so part of the reason we don't see mass protests against this, or at least greater protests against this, is because for men to protest and say that they were harmed is in some way perceived as an admission that there's something wrong with them or wrong with their sexuality, or that they're deficient in some way. And so the wound or the cultural beliefs around circumcision are set up to prevent people from talking about it because it makes the person wrong for having the wound rather than society wrong for having committed the wound.
That's an excellent summary of it. Yes. Yeah. So the net result is that men don't want to view themselves as cowards. Well, I'm too scared to speak out. I mean, no man wants to think that to himself, you know. So it's easier to think, well, it can't be that big a deal. I'm circumcised. I have good sex, 3 kids. My wife isn't complaining. And the thing goes on. And what enrages me most is that American doctors don't tell parents that the rest of the world, pediatricians, don't do it. And most have condemned it.
What do you think is the solution to this cultural blindness around the issue?
Shocking the public. If a book could do it, it would have happened by now. I mean, I love all the books that have been written and the movies. I love all of it. And it all plays a part in it. And so does the shock. So does the shock and awe of Bloodstained Men, of our protest. There's no one knockout punch that's going to end this nightmare, because it is implanted in our flesh. It's implanted in the flesh of our sons and our grandsons. The best way to ensure that a man will circumcise his own sons is to circumcise him. And that takes you 15 minutes. And we are spending our lives trying to undo 15 minutes of damage in the life of millions of individuals. It's a Herculean task before us. And I like to think that in your lifetime, certainly, we will reach the point where Australia is right now. 50 years ago, Australia was, with the circumcision, they were where we in the United States are right now. And I do believe that, I know it to be a fact, that we are headed in that direction. We're headed in the same direction as Denmark is. Someday in the United States, there will be intact legislators and judges who will be debating what they're now debating in Denmark. Should all boys be protected like girls from genital mutilation? But we're a far distance from that, as you know, from that culture. But that's where we're headed. That's where we're headed. Our job as intactivists is to make it happen. Well, it's not inevitable. but intactivism is an inevitable force. So as long as intactivists are alive, there is an inevitability about the course of this struggle, which is that we will prevail. But the time frame is not clear. We're making progress every year, no doubt about that.
So from your perspective, what is the best way to make progress? Or another way of asking that is, when you stage a protest or an event or something like that, what is your process for doing that? What from your perspective makes a successful protest or event of some kind to awaken the public on this issue?
We put together road crews, anywhere from 4 to 12 people, and we land on a busy street corner in the middle of a city in the United States. And we want as many people as possible to see our signs, our outfits, to talk to us and to take our information cards. The first thing that we really look to is having local people come out and join us. And they do. It always feels like the cavalry is coming, because we're 4, 5, 10 men and women, strangers in this town, and we're human too. We need support. We need to see support. We need to feel the support. And when we see local moms and their husbands and their children as they're walking toward us, and so, often they'll be carrying signs, it is just such a feeling of happiness that we're not alone. We're not alone. There are people coming out to join us and do this with us, people who feel strongly enough to come out and do this with us. So that's the first thing that happens at a Blessed Amen protest that I consider a measure of the day's success, is how many local families or individuals will come out and protest with us, because every protest movement needs numbers to succeed. If we had 2,000 people, that clearly is different than 20 people. So when local parents come out, that is just, it's a force magnifier, multiplier. Secondly, we will have sent out a press release. Sometimes a radio station will call in. We'll do a radio interview over the phone. Or people, passersby will stop by and say, hey, they're talking about you right now on such and such a radio station. And we're like, yes. Or we'll be all over it. And this we don't see as much. It depends on what kind of group it is. But the local Facebook groups, unrelated to our issue, but just, the crazy things that happen in, Dayton, Ohio type Facebook group, people will be posting pictures in there, and other people will see that. And now I got to go see that. And now I got to get that picture. So they drive by. But at some point, we really, really appreciate it and are grateful when the mainstream media in that town comes out and interviews us, talks to us. We will have sent out a press release. And that's hit and miss. If the newsroom director, if the news director of that newspaper or that TV studio is a parent who has a circumcised child, they may or may not be open to covering our story. But so it's hit and miss. But as you mentioned earlier, we have had quite a bit of success in mainstream media coverage, including Time Magazine, which did a Super Bowl photo of us several years ago, the New York Daily News, the Daily Mail in the UK covered us. The Washington Times did a big article on the Bloodstained Men and the Intactivist Movement. So clearly, and TV stations, the local TV stations, not just the print journals, but knowing that our protest has reached people who didn't see it, who didn't drive by it, that really inspires us. Because it's hard being out there. It's hard work. We're all volunteers. No one's paid. A lot of the people who jeer at us can't believe it. They don't. Their experience in life is that no one does anything for free. No one has any convictions that, would merit such activity. You have to be paid. And when we tell them, no, we're all volunteers, some don't believe it. They think, well, who are you covering for? Who's paying you? No one in Blessed Amen gets paid. We are all volunteers. We protest for 5 hours. I usually try to go straight through without a break. And I think most of the others try to do the same. Some people might take a 15 or 20 minute, 30 minute break for a lunch. We pack some snack bars in our gear. But at the end of the day, at 3 o'clock when we wrap it up, we're on to the next city, and we'll be on the street the next morning at 10 a.m. So it's hard, but it's very rewarding knowing that we were seen, we were heard, and we did as much as we could in that city. And now it's on to the next city.
It sounds like for you, a successful protest is one where you bring shocking or powerful symbols of some kind that draws local support and gets media attention, both through social media and local, and maybe even sometimes national media, because of that local support. And the protest itself and the symbols and visuals and images from it extend beyond just that one physical event into something that people can share across the world and talk about.
Yes, yes. And we've even seen some of our African friends are doing protests. And I mean, the United States is just guilty of such fraud in at least 14 African nations, and probably more. I saw another figure. Someone said that it's actually 20. There's just 14 official nations where we're promoting circumcision. The United States is USAID, the President's Commission on HIV, PEPFAR, the CDC. It's an incestuous relationship between all these bureaucratic entities that want to circumcise the American people. In my opinion, the reason for the American crusade in Africa, of course, these circumcision fanatics in the government bureaucracies do want to circumcise all men. They do want to spread circumcision. But I believe their chief concern is using Africa as a testing ground for what propaganda works so that they can bring it back and use it in the United States against our people. And in fact, that's what they've done with the HIV. They did a crooked, unethical, rigged experiment on African men on circumcision, and then use those results. And you'll find it on most of the major medical websites now in the United States, citing the African studies, fraudulent African studies, as reason to circumcise your baby boy in an American hospital. So in my opinion, that is the ultimate incentive for them to put so much effort into their African circumcision crusade, is to use it against the American people as evidence to support perpetuating the circumcision of our sons in the United States. I know that's not the question you asked me, but
related. I might do an entire episode just on that particular aspect of the issue in the future, which is why I was hesitant to get too far down that rabbit hole now.
There's just so much in this issue, Brendan. And I know you dealt with that yourself with the movie. Just how do you talk about something so massive in a coherent and easy way, in a way that can easily be digested?
Well, that's one of the things I find really interesting about your work, is that you have found a way to talk about a very large issue through visual symbols. And there's that saying that a picture is worth 1,000 words. And so if you have that much that you want to say, the right symbol can communicate it very quickly. That's one of the things I was curious about with the symbol of the bloodstained men, if that was something that, I mean, you said you just sort of, when you saw it, you put on the bloodstained suit for a protest, that you just intuitively knew this is the symbol. Is that something that you, I guess I'm curious if there was a way that you knew, or if it was just an unconscious knowing?
I knew it was brilliant.
What about that symbol do you feel like connects with people?
We were still in New Orleans. It was right around my birthday, October 22nd. We were at the AAP convention 2012 in New Orleans. We had just put them on, right around that time frame, 23rd, 21st, 24th, something like that. It's all documented. James Lowen interviewed me a day or two later. We went and sat around the block from the protest in New Orleans. This was several weeks before I came up with the concept of an organization or of a Facebook page and the name Bloodstained Men. But I told James Lowen, and I say it with just as much fervor as I said it then. I told him at the time, this is the most powerful protest symbol in human history. I've never seen one like it. that directly correlates to what is being protested. The bloody crotch right there at the site of the wound. It is brilliant. It's brilliant. It was a leap of the imagination for Richard Dunker in the UK who thought of it. And like many of the cultural innovations throughout history, someone else comes along and builds. Jonathan Conti, he felt enough of its power. He made seven suits. And he wasn't, I was reading Marilyn Milos's discussion about it several days ago. It came up in my memories. And he had expressed to her, they apparently flew out to New Orleans together. He was saying, I hope some of the other men will put these on. And she told him, well, I think they will. But I knew it was brilliant. From the moment I put it on and saw it on the other men, I knew it was a conscious awareness. This is it.
So I'm curious, what was the process? You discovered this symbol. What was the process from going from that discovery and that initial instinct that this was a brilliant symbol to then building a protest group around it? Because I think a lot of people involved in the movement would love to do something like what you've done and be able to travel and protest and hold events that get similar amounts of attention, but they're not sure how to go from, you know, just a good idea to actually implementing it. So I'm curious what that journey was to forming this into an organization.
Let me preface this by saying, I think that a circumcision protest without bloodstains is still hugely effective. It doesn't have to be a bloodstain men protest. I think families, moms, dads, children in your local community, if you get together, you make your own signs. I mean, I have just seen brilliant signs that parents make, and they don't have to be complex. I mean, his body, his choice. Genital mutilation is a violation of fundamental human rights, but a group of parents standing on a street corner in any town, USA, is highly effective. And if you do that in your city, if you don't want to do it in your city where, you know, your next door neighbor might drive by and, you know, start gossiping about you, do it in the biggest city 10 miles down the highway. Go to the big city, you know, next door. Do it there. Let the press know that you're going to be there. Call up the TV station. Call up the newspaper. Sometimes I saw them cover a protest in Illinois several years ago that happened just like that. But having said that, for me, when I left New Orleans after the AAP convention with this bloodstained suit that Jonathan Conti made with this bloodstained suit in my suitcase, flew back to California around October 25th or so, there was a new way to protest circumcision, and that I was going to do it. I knew that. There was a protest scheduled that weekend in San Francisco at the Moscone Center. There, right around that time, well, I shouldn't say right around that time. At that time, began a debate about the bloodstained suit. And some people thought that it should be put on a shelf and saved for special occasions. They said, well, people will get used to it. Too many people, it'll become commonplace. And I said, no, because at every protest, you've got different people passing by every day. It's not the same. It's not the same audience. It's not the same group of people. But so there were a lot of debates on social media about advisability of wearing a bloodstained man suit for protesting. So that weekend after I got home, I went to the Bay Area Intactivist protest in San Francisco. And I said to Jonathan Conti, because I viewed Jonathan Conti as the spokesperson for this idea. It certainly did not occur to me that it would be my bailiwick. I said, how would you feel if I wear the bloodstained men's suit at this weekend's protest? And he said, well, we don't have any dress requirements, whatever you want to do. I refined it a bit. I went and bought the original suits that he bought were just, you know, the big painter's coveralls. So I went and got a nice white dress shirt and a pair of white carpenter slacks, which look pretty good. I mean, they, you know, they're just like Levi's, but they're white. And I put civilian clothes over them, took Amtrak to San Francisco, and showed up at the Bay Area Intactivist protest. Unfortunately, I guess due to schedule conflicts or whatnot, I was the only protester who showed up that weekend. I put in a lot of hours there, and a young, ambitious doctor, I can't remember his name now, but he took my picture and was, I mean, he had high praise for it, and he tweeted it. I think that was the first social media tweet for Bloodstained Men. There were two back-to-back days of protests there. I think it was the deans of med school, something like that. But another dean of a med school, he took my picture and he said, I'm going to send this to my friend. He's a pediatric urologist. And he tells me about, he told me that half his business is doing reconstructive, but it shocked me that in retrospect, I don't know if he said half, but it was a number approaching half. It might've been a quarter of his, but we know that that's just the fact of life for pediatric surgeons in the United States, that a great percentage of their business is doing penis reconstruction, reconstructive surgery on babies because of circumcision. So after that weekend scene, and of course there were a couple of doctors that cursed me out and gave me the finger. Doctors.
It's so funny to me when people talk about how, we have to behave, you know, it's funny to me when people make comments about intactivist protests not appearing in the way that they would prefer that they look, and then have nothing to say about doctors who walk by those protests and use curse words and body shame people and make foul comments. So it's interesting to me that from the first protest you did with the bloodstained suit, that was present, that sort of polarized reaction where there was, it sounds like, one doctor who loved it and said, I'm so glad someone's talking about this, and shared it on social media. Several. And then there were others who were just very triggered and had a very different reaction.
Oh, yeah. Again, that was extremely reinforcing to get that much support from doctors at the convention. And it continues to be that way. We have a lot of trouble. Well, I shouldn't say a lot of trouble. It's nigh impossible to get them to go on record at convention protests, but we get a lot of silent support or behind the scenes support from doctors at the medical convention protests.
So they'll say, I love what you're doing. Don't tell my peers.
I can't say it though. Don't quote me. No pictures.
Well, okay. But we're on a podcast. You know, it's out there now that there might be behind the scenes some doctors who support the bloodstained men. We're not saying that there are, but there might be.
So after that weekend of solo protesting at the medical gathering at the Moscone Center in San Francisco, I did that 2 weeks in a row. So there might have been 2 weekends in a row. So we're now on the first week of November. So my birthday was October 22nd in New Orleans when I first wore the bloodstained suit. So now about 2 weeks later, we're now in the first week of November. And I came home here to Davis after 2 weekends of successful bloodstained men protesting in San Francisco. I had been active on Facebook already at that point since earlier that year. This was 2012. I went on Facebook in July 2012. So I had been active on Facebook for about half a year at that point. And I thought I should start a Facebook page. And the first thing I had to consider is, what do I call it? What do we call it? What is this phenomenon? What do I call it? And it might seem, in retrospect, it might seem like, duh. But it wasn't at the time. I spent 3 or 4 hours and had a list, probably 10 or 20.
Can you give us a name for bloodstained men that was on your brainstorm list that was not used? Or are they too much of a failed experiment? I'm kind of curious.
There probably was something as simple as people against circumcision. I mean, I don't know. Honestly, I don't remember, but I remember when I finally wrote down bloodstained men, and that's it. And that was the first Tuesday first Tuesday or Wednesday in November. It's on the page. You just have to, it's, you know, like November 5th, 6th, 7th, something like that. But the beginning of November, and then I thought, well, it can't be Bloodstained Men and Women. Can't be that. And then I thought, well, and their friends would encompass everybody who wanted to join us. I've always liked the ampersand. So I put the ampersand in there, Bloodstained Men and their friends. And I made the Facebook page.
It sounds like you almost built this to an organization through sheer persistence and energy, that you would do something, you would take lots of, you know, massive action, you would get energy from taking that action and then just keep going and take more action. And that's one of the things that I appreciate about your work is the prolificness of your output, because there's a lot of people who want to do activism around this, who spend a lot of time thinking and debating what the best way to do it is. And it sounds like that you do what a lot of startup founders do, which is that you just create as much as possible and innovate as you go.
Yeah, and I think that is the essence of a grassroots movement, which is what we are. It's grassroots, and it has been from the beginning. All volunteers, just people who feel as strongly as I do about this issue, and that it's a travesty of justice. It's a crime against our sons. It's criminal activity under the guise of medicine.
At what point did the protest stop being just you and you started having other people say, hey, I want to join you?
It didn't take long. So I founded Bloodstained Men and Their Friends the first week of November 2012. The first week of the next month, December, we actually did a Bloodstained Men protest at the California State Capitol. And we had men and women and children come out there to the California State Capitol. I think we had 8 or 10 or 12 of us, men and women, wearing the bloodstains. So and simultaneous to this, the Germans, in fact, Jonathan Friedman happened to be in Germany at that time because there were dramatic events taking place in Germany. I believe 12/12 became a day of darkness in Germany. I believe it was the day that the German parliament passed a law, 12/12. I believe it was December 12th, but it was right there in early November 2012. The German parliament passed a law that essentially avoided the decision earlier that year by a Cologne court that infant circumcision was bodily injury and illegal. So Jonathan Friedman happened to be over there, and a whole group of 10 or 15 Germans, including Jonathan Friedman, put on bloodstained suits for their protest there in Berlin. So it happened right away. And then we started planning Bloodstained Men protest to be part of the next year's GIAW, which is the Genital Integrity Awareness Week in 2013 in Washington, D.C. And there were a few dramatic protests or at least one dramatic protest before that. But the first really major gathering of Bloodstained Men and Women was at the nation's capital. And I believe on the very lawn that was in the news recently, but that's where we stood there looking with Washington Monument behind us. James Lowen took an epic photograph of, I think there's 25 or 30 people in that photograph, all in bloodstains. So that was 2013. But then later that year, Jonathan Friedman wrote me. He said, let's do a New England protest. And I said, all right, let's do it. And I flew out to New York City. He met me at the airport. We did a week or 10 days up through New England. And again, local activists came out and joined us along the way, and different people put us up in their houses. I mean, we were doing it on a shoestring. We were not, Bloodstained Men was not a nonprofit. So this was all coming out of my pocket, but you know, it was well worth it.
One of the things that you've mentioned is that you have an incredible amount of energy for this. And it's an issue that a lot of people burn out on, or the shockingness of it is too much for them in some way. So I'm curious how it is that you maintain that energy and why it is you feel that you've had such an ability to create so prolifically and do this much work where others have sometimes struggled or felt burnout.
That thought that I had in the early 70s, why isn't there a protest movement against circumcision? people are protesting everything. Why aren't they protesting circumcision? The awareness just grew over the years that I couldn't expect someone else to do it. And I'm well situated to do it now. And there's never any lack of work. And so many others are helping. So many others are pitching in. It's the growth has been exponential of the people working on this problem. I don't have a choice, really. It's a moral imperative. It really is.
You know, we've mentioned the word spiritual wound around circumcision a couple times. And I'm wondering if you could define that. What does it mean that this is a spiritual wound?
We all get one life. It's axiomatic, but true. We get one life. If we're lucky, we get 100 years or more, or maybe a little bit less. But we get one life. Your sex life is arguably among the most important, if not the most important, personal aspect of your life, and certainly responsible for the family you have, for raising it, for the fact that you bring children into the world. Life, even for people who have no religion, life has a mystical or a spiritual, some sort of transcendental aura or aspect. Most people would agree is just part of what it feels like to be alive. We don't just feel like knuckle dragging animals, looking for our next meal, and we live and die, and that's it. There's a mystical yearning in life, to connect to the spiritual dimension. To me, is the highest achievement of human consciousness is to reach that level of spirituality. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult to reach it. It's very difficult to maintain it. It can be challenging to believe in it. Life is a test of faith and belief for all of us. When you strap down a baby and cut off part of his organ of procreation, he is being assaulted on so many levels. His body, obviously, his body. And unfortunately, when you denude the glands of the penis, it creates a sense of a discordant note in the way your body feels. And men learn to live with this and aren't even aware of it. The body is rendered, you are rendered uncomfortable in your own skin when your penis has been stripped of the covering of the glands. You know the concept of homeostasis. There's a psychological comfort to being alive when you're warm and well fed and you're with friends. There's a psychological comfort that we all know and obviously treasure and seek, and we want to repeat it on a daily basis. There is no psychological comfort in having part of your penis cut off. And that psychological discomfort extends all the way to the bottom of your soul. I don't know how else to say it other than it is a spiritual wound. It hits at the very core of your existence as a human being, leaving you uncomfortable in your own body and spirit. The denial of that discomfort and the need to deny that discomfort is why so many men and even women who have circumcised their own sons or live with or have a circumcision, why the denial is so angry and adamant and even stubborn. Intactivists are always surprised by the level of resistance and denial that we meet, but it's because the wound goes to the very essence of our humanity, of our spiritual, of the spiritual aspect of what it means to be a human being. And not just another knuckle-dragging animal, sniffing about for our daily bread. It's a good question, Brendan. And as you can see, it's challenging, and even how to answer it.
It strikes me that is part of the reason that you may have chosen the visual symbol you have, is that a lot of that is encapsulated in the idea of the bloodstain. Is there anything else that you want to talk about this issue that I haven't asked about that you think we should, or that we haven't explored yet? I know there's always more that we could explore, but if there's something in particular.
Right. Well, what you say, the bloodstain, the bloodstain does capture exactly what is being done to men and in the cultures that circumcise women. But interestingly enough, we are putting up billboards across the country. We've been very fortunate to find a billboard company that will deal with us. We had several billboard companies that said, we will put up your text message, but we can't put up the image.
Wow. They
would not put up the image. So it is, the image is powerful and probably merits an entire book. It's so complicated. I mean, in all its dimensions and what it represents and what it stirs up in people and in the people who wear it.
I should ask, what is it you feel when you wear that symbol or that others have told you that they experience? Because it sounds like for you, things like the change in your name or the use of a particular symbol have a psychological and spiritual component to them. And so I'm curious what you experience around that.
Vindication. Vindication, that it matters. That it matters, that the suffering matters, and revealing the suffering, that it matters, and that it helps others when you are willing to reveal it.
What happens when you reveal it in that way? What is it you think changes or occurs?
People want to be part of it. People want to think, yes, I can do that too. I can say that too. I can think that. People don't want to view themselves as cowards or as meek on an issue like this. Inherent to living, to surviving is courage. And it takes a certain amount, it takes a lot of courage to confront this issue, stare it right straight in the face and say, circumcision, you are wrong. You are criminal. And to change society, this is a social revolution. It really is. And that's why it upsets so many people. It disturbs the status quo, and it upsets so many people.
It sounds like the larger culture talking about this issue is framed as weakness, but it actually requires a lot of courage to talk about it. And that this particular symbol and is a way of reclaiming that particular issue and taking it from something that would be a source of guilt or shame to talk about, but framing it as an act of courage instead and saying, no, I'm not going to let you shame me for talking about this. The power is actually mine in some way.
Interesting. Yeah.
And part of the challenge of it too is that I've heard it said that truth is often very simple and lies are complex. So deconstructing all the different layers of a lie can often take more than the initial lie took. So we were talking about the HIV claims around circumcision earlier. The statement that from the African trials that circumcision somehow reduces the risk of HIV is very short, but breaking down all the methodological flaws in those studies and the fact that they were funded as opposed to other potential solutions in Africa, that just, it's a very complex topic and it takes more energy to refute the nonsense than it does to actually put it out there in the first place.
Yes. Especially when there are a couple of fanatics that make it their life's work to get it out there.
So is there anything else that we should talk about that we haven't gotten the chance to that you want to make sure to say on this issue or this particular topic or in this interview?
No, I think thank you for all the excellent questions, the follow-ups, your own observations and suggestions. It's an ongoing conversation, Brendan, and intactivism will prevail.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan Marotta Show. If you liked this episode, please share it with someone else who would also like it, and then go on whatever platform you listen to the show on and leave a positive review. If you want to support the show directly, go to brendanmarotta.com/show and subscribe there. Paid subscribers get special unreleased bonus material and live events that are only available to them. Once again, that is brendanmarotta.com/show. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you all later.